It's the early years of the 6th century in Subiaco, Italy, about 40 miles outside of Rome. We are in a small room used as a refectory by a group of monks. They are preparing for their daily meal, awaiting the arrival of the head of their community, a local man who was a hermit who became known for his holiness and was begged by this community of monks to be their abbot after theirs had passed away. But now, after experiencing the strictness of his spiritual leadership, which was more rigorous than they were used to and did not allow for a more lax way of life, they had grown bitter and disgruntled, and probably envious of the man's holiness. So as they await the beginning of the meal, they exchange nervous glances. Holding the cup of wine that they are to present to their abbot, they await his blessing. Benedict then blesses the cup, and it shatters. The monks had poisoned the wine in an attempt to rid themselves of their superior. Benedict's reaction to this attempted murder surprises them. According to St. Gregory the Great, who wrote a life of St. Benedict, he says, quote, "Almighty God of his mercy forgive you, brethren. Why have you dealt thus with me? Did not I foretell you that my manner of life and yours would not agree? Go and seek a superior to your liking, for you can have me no longer with you." Unquote. This attempt at communal life with other monks seems to have failed, and Benedict longs to go back to his cave to live an ascetical but joyful life in solitude, which he had done previously for 3 years. He does return to his cave, but God's providence will not allow him to remain as he is, and the very life and future of all of Europe will radically change when Benedict emerges from the cave and heads to Monte Cassino. There he will write his rule, which, within 300 years, will become the blueprint for monasticism in all the West. This is a walk through Catholic history, where we visit the most significant events in the life of Christ Church on Earth throughout the ages. Episode 5, Saint Benedict and the Contributions of Western Monasticism. The Western Roman Empire had fallen about 5 years before Benedict was born, when in 476 the barbarian king Odoacer deposed the last Western Roman emperor Romulus Augustulus. Rome, therefore, was obviously not in a great state, and when Benedict went to Rome about the age of 20 for his schooling, he was scandalized by the quality of education and the moral state of the place. For the health of his soul, therefore, he decided to move to the countryside and lodged in a church in the town of Afile, outside of Rome. Later on, desiring even greater solitude, he moved to Subiaco, where he met a monk named Romanus, who counseled him and encouraged him in his desire to become more perfect. Romanus helped him begin his life as a hermit in a cave in Subiaco. While living a life of great asceticism and prayer in his cave cell, he became renowned for his holiness and was said to have worked several miracles. It was at this point that he was approached by the group of monks mentioned in the beginning, and while he desired to remain a hermit, he reluctantly agreed to become their superior. As we know, this first attempt at cenobitic or communal monastic life did not end well, but after returning to his cave and growing in wisdom and holiness over the next few years, Benedict finally did emerge from the cave and established 12 monastic communities in and around Subiaco. Before getting to Benedict's move to Monte Cassino and the writing of his famous rule, we should review the history of monasticism, which did not begin with Benedict or even in the West. Over 200 years before the birth of Saint Benedict, monasticism was widespread in the East, particularly in Egypt. Eastern monasticism became even more widespread and widely known due to the sanctity of Saint Anthony of Egypt, one of the first great hermits, and Saint Pachomius, who is considered the founder of cenobitic monasticism. The life and holiness of Saint Anthony of Egypt was introduced into the West primarily through works written about his life by Saint Athanasius and Saint Jerome. Saint Basil of Caesarea was probably the first to write rules of monasticism after studying and living among the desert hermits in Egypt. Saint John Cassian also began as a monk in the deserts of Egypt and then established monasteries in what is modern-day France. His two great works, the Institutes and the Conferences, had a great influence on Saint Benedict. So if Christian monasticism already had a long history before Benedict, in the East with Saint Anthony of Egypt and Saint Basil and others, and in the West with Saint John Cassian, Saint Martin of Tours and others, why does Benedict hold such a prominent place, and why is he considered the father of Western monasticism? We have already been introduced to the two forms of monasticism, eremitical monasticism, or living as a hermit, and cenobitic monasticism, which involves communal life. When one intends to seek out perfection and spiritual intimacy with God, great prudence is required, and one ought to be guided by and submissive to a superior who is more advanced in the spiritual life. This is why the eremitical form of monasticism is more rare. Left to one's own devices, a hermit can easily be misled and unaware of subtle spiritual temptations brought by the devil. Communal monasticism under an abbot is a more common vocation. Still, if a monk seeks perfection, he cannot be given too much to busy work or chatter or activity with others. This is why there still needs to be an element of solitude in the monastic life. When living as a monk, it's also important to attend to both elements of man's nature, his soul and his body. Being immoderate in bodily penance can do damage to the soul, and being lax in the spiritual life can lead to sins of the flesh. Human nature also requires a balance between work and prayer for growth in virtue and holiness. Exercising the body while working to support oneself in the community is balanced by the work of God or the liturgy, which is the most important element of the monastic life. Benedict, in his rule, reached the most prudent and effective integration of all of these elements, synthesizing the wisdom taken from St. Anthony of Egypt, St. Basil, St. John Cassian, St. Augustine, the anonymous rule of the Master, and other sources. St. Benedict is known as the father of Western monasticism because this rule, which is already a spiritual masterpiece in itself, led to an unprecedented spiritual and cultural flourishing throughout Western Europe. You will recall from last week's episode that the Carolingian Renaissance under Emperor Charlemagne was inspired in part by the rule of St. Benedict, and he promoted it throughout the entire empire. How it is exactly that a monastic rule, which to all appearances seems to focus mainly on the cultivation of virtue, especially humility and obedience, and on very practical matters of the running of a monastery, could lead to such a flourishing of intellectual pursuits as was seen during all of the Middle Ages, will be explained later. First, we return to Benedict's life and his journey to Monte Cassino, where he will establish his most important monastery and where he will write his rule. Though Benedict had founded 12 monasteries in Subiaco, he still experienced persecution and threats to his life, both from his own monks and from a local priest. He therefore went to Monte Cassino, a mountain about 60 miles away, to establish a new kind of monastery, one that would allow for a larger community of monks to live in common, with a balance both of work and prayer, and solitude and community. When he arrived at the mountain, there had been built many years before a temple to the pagan god Apollo. Benedict destroyed this temple and consecrated the mountain to God by building chapels and his monastery over the ruins of the pagan temple. He lived the rest of his life at Monte Cassino, a mere 10 years. The most important fruit of his time there undoubtedly being the rule that he wrote, which was the culmination of all the various forms of monastic life that he had lived and tried. We read in the Catholic Encyclopedia, quote, "When Saint Benedict came to write his own rule for the monasteries he had founded, he embodied in it the result of his own mature experience and observation. He had himself lived the life of a solitary after the most extreme Egyptian pattern, and in his first communities he had no doubt thoroughly tested the prevailing type of monastic rule. Being fully cognizant, therefore, of the unsuitability of much in the Egyptian systems to the times and circumstances in which he lived, he now struck out on a new line, and instead of attempting to revivify the old forms of asceticism, he consolidated the cenobitical life, emphasized the family spirit, and discouraged all private venture and austerities. His rule thus consists of a carefully considered combination of old and new ideas. Rivalry and austerity was eliminated, and there was to be henceforth a sinking of the individual in the community. In adapting a system essentially Eastern to Western conditions, Saint Benedict gave it coherence, stability, and organization, and the verdict of history is unanimous in applauding the results of such adaptation. In considering the leading characteristics of this holy rule, the first that must strike the reader is its wonderful discretion and moderation, its extreme reasonableness, and its keen insight into the capabilities as well as the weaknesses of human nature. Here are no excesses, no extraordinary asceticism, no narrow-mindedness, but rather a series of sober regulations based on sound common sense." Unquote. What exactly is in this rule which has gained so much praise? It's not a lengthy document, containing only 73 very brief chapters. To get at St. Benedict's intention in writing the rule, we read a few excerpts from the prologue. Quote, "Hearken continually within thine heart, O son, giving attentive ear to the precepts of thy master. Understand with willing mind and effectually fulfill thy Holy Father's admonition, that thou mayest return, by labor of obedience, to him from whom by the idleness of disobedience thou hast withdrawn. To this end I now address a word of exhortation to thee, whosoever thou art, who, renouncing thine own will and taking up the bright and all-conquering weapons of obedience, dost enter upon the service of thy true King, Christ the Lord. We have therefore to establish a school of the Lord's service, in the institution of which we hope we are going to establish nothing harsh, nothing burdensome. But if, prompted by the desire to attain to equity, anything be set forth somewhat strictly for the correction of vice or the preservation of charity, do not therefore in fear and terror flee back from the way of salvation, of which the beginning cannot but be a narrow entrance. For it is by progressing in the life of conversion and faith that, with heart enlarged and in ineffable sweetness of love, one runs in the way of God's commandments, so that never deserting his discipleship, but persevering until death in his doctrine within the monastery, we may partake by patience in the suffering of Christ and become worthy inheritors of his kingdom. Amen." Unquote. The initial chapters lay out the necessary qualities of the abbot and the monks. Expanding upon the corporal and spiritual works of mercy we hear in the Gospel, he lists 72 precepts, or the instruments of good works as he calls them. Major themes in all of this are humility, obedience, the necessity of good works, silence, and remaining in the presence of God. The latter chapters are dedicated to daily practical concerns regarding food, work, clothing, worship, hospitality, etc. So with such a simply stated intention, and with such basic rules for common life and the pursuit of holiness, why was this rule so effective in bringing about both a flourishing of monastic life in Europe and a flourishing in so many areas of culture? The rule itself says nothing or very little about agriculture, education, copying of books, medicine, philosophy, music, or other areas of culture which it ended up affecting. A few reasons might be given. First, if one truly desires holiness, he must come to a proper understanding of who he himself is, who God is, what his relation to God is, what is the nature of the various parts of creation given to us by God, and what is man's relation to that creation, and how is he to use it. God created the world to be known, and human beings as knowers. To become perfect entails using our minds to come to know the Creator through His creation. Therefore, God can be known in some way in any truth, wherever it is found. Hence the monks had a reverence for all wisdom, ancient, new, pagan, or Christian. Also consider that in the prologue, there are many mentions of good deeds and works. He mentioned the monks as entering into the service of the Lord. Service is an important part of the monastic life, as laid out in the rule. Serving Christ in worship, and serving Him in our neighbor. Because of this emphasis on good deeds, there is a duty to better the world and humanity, to treat all like Christ. As St. Benedict says in the rule, quote, "...to honor all men, to relieve the poor, to clothe the naked, to visit the sick, to bury the dead, to help in tribulation, to console the sorrowing, to utter only truth from heart and mouth." Unquote. This recognition of the duty to serve God and neighbor accounts for how these monasteries contributed so much to civilization. The emphasis on humility and obedience regards not only obedience to the superior, but also in being obedient to the truth, in seeking it everywhere and submitting to it, which again is an explanation of the monastic love for learning as a means to know God. An even clearer connection can be made between the rule and its effects in Europe. Again quoting from the Catholic Encyclopedia, quote, "Though it was no part of St. Benedict's design that his spiritual descendants should make a figure in the world as authors or statesmen, as preservers of pagan literature, as pioneers of civilization, as revivers of agriculture, or as builders of castles and cathedrals, yet circumstances brought them into all these spheres. His sole idea was the moral and spiritual training of his disciples, and yet in carrying this out, he made the cloister a school of useful workers, a real refuge for society, and a solid bulwark of the Church. The rule, instead of restricting the monk to one particular form of work, makes it possible for him to do almost any kind of work, and that in a manner spiritualized and elevated above the labor of merely secular craftsmen. In this lies one of the secrets of its success. The results of the fulfillment of the precepts of the rule are abundantly apparent in history. That of manual labor, for instance, which St. Benedict laid down as absolutely essential for his monks, produced many of the architectural triumphs which are the glory of the Christian world. Many cathedrals, abbeys, and churches scattered up and down the countries of Western Europe were the work of Benedictine builders and architects. The cultivation of the soil, encouraged by St. Benedict, was another form of labor to which his followers gave themselves without reserve and with conspicuous success, so that many regions have owed much of their agricultural prosperity to the skillful husbandry of the sons of St. Benedict. The hours ordered by the rule to be devoted daily to systematic reading and study have given to the world many of the foremost scholars and writers, so that the term Benedictine erudition has been for long centuries a byword indicative of the learning and laborious research fostered in the Benedictine cloister. The regulations regarding the reception and education of children, moreover, were the germ from which sprang up a great number of famous monastic schools and universities which flourished in the Middle Ages. Unquote. On the subject of the contribution of the monks to the practical arts, Thomas E. Woods, in his book How the Catholic Church Built Western Civilization, says, quote, "Manual labor, expressly called for in the rule of St. Benedict, played a central role in the monastic life. Although the rule was known for its moderation and its aversion to exaggerated penances, we often find the monks freely embracing work that was difficult and unattractive, since for them such tasks were channels of grace and opportunities for mortification of the flesh. This was certainly true in the clearing and reclaiming of land. The prevailing view of swamps was that they were sources of pestilence utterly without value. But the monks thrived in such locations and embraced the challenges that came with them. Before long, they managed to dike and drain the swamp and turn what had once been a source of disease and filth into fertile agricultural land. Wherever they went, the monks introduced crops, industries, or production methods with which the people had not been previously familiar. Here they would introduce the rearing of cattle and horses, there the brewing of beer or the raising of bees or fruit. Monks stored up the waters from springs in order to distribute them in times of drought. In Lombardy, the peasants learned irrigation from the monks, which contributed mightily to making that area so well known throughout Europe for its fertility and riches. The monks were also the first to work toward improving cattle breeds, rather than leaving the process to chance. The monks also pioneered in the production of wine, which they used both for the celebration of Holy Mass and for ordinary consumption. The monks were also important architects of medieval technology. Thanks to the great network of communication that existed between the various monasteries, technological information was able to spread rapidly. These monasteries, a scholar writes, were the most economically effective units that had ever existed in Europe and perhaps in the world before that time. Monastic accomplishments ranged from interesting curiosities to the intensely practical. In the early 11th century, for instance, a monk named Aylmer flew more than 600 feet with a glider. The monks also counted skillful clockmakers among them. The first clock of which we have any record was built by the future Pope Sylvester II for the German town of Magdeburg around the year 996. Much more sophisticated clocks were built by later monks. Peter Lightfoot, a 14th century monk of Glastonbury, built one of the oldest clocks still in existence, which now sits in excellent condition in London Science Museum. Richard of Wallingford, a 14th century abbot of the Benedictine Abbey of St. Albans and one of the initiators of Western trigonometry, is well known for the large astronomical clock he designed for that monastery. It has been said that a clock that equaled it in technological sophistication did not appear for at least two centuries. Archaeologists are still discovering the extent of monastic skills and technological cleverness. In the late 1990s, University of Bradford archaeometallurgist Jerry McDonnell found evidence near Ravoux Abbey in North Yorkshire, England, of a degree of technological sophistication that pointed ahead to the great machines of the 18th century Industrial Revolution. In exploring the debris of Ravoux and Laskill, McDonnell found that the monks had built a furnace to extract iron from ore. McDonnell believes that the monks were on the verge of building dedicated furnaces for the large-scale production of cast iron, and that the furnace at Laskill had been a prototype of such a furnace. The monks had the potential to move to blast furnaces that produced nothing but cast iron. They were poised to do it on a large scale, but by breaking up the virtual monopoly, Henry VIII effectively broke up that potential. Had it not been for a greedy king's suppression of the English monasteries, therefore, the monks appear to have been on the verge of ushering in the industrial era and its related explosion in wealth, population, and life expectancy figures. That development would instead have to wait for 2.5 more centuries." Unquote. This is only a very small sample of all of the things the monks contributed to civilization. At the very least, hopefully it can put to rest the myth of the Dark Ages. In fact, were it not for the monks and the church, Europe truly would have fallen into illiterate and superstitious Dark Ages. but the effect of Saint Benedict and his monasteries shows the harmony between faith and reason, religion and science. Many ill-informed people today still believe the Church to be opposed to science and learning, that she requires blind, irrational assent. But hopefully, through the intercession of Saint Benedict and all the other great monastic saints, the light of the gospel might shine again in our age, which in truth can be called a dark age, and inspire all, whether they be scientists, educators, artists, laborers, etc., to do those things which truly lead to human flourishing, and to build up the world in accordance with the gospel. As Saint Benedict says in his rule, "What, most dear brethren, could be more sweet to us than this voice of the Lord inviting us? Behold, the Lord points out the way of life to us by his own fatherly affection. Let our loins then be girt with faith and the observance of good works, and let us, gospel-led, pursue his paths, that we may be worthy to see him who has called us unto his own kingdom."